dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the people who brings incredible intelligence to bear on matters involving that war and much more is our first guest. She is a woman who is, well, an extraordinary resource in so many media. She is a Fox News analyst, the columnist and editor at The Washington Times, a New York Times bestseller, notably for What the Bleep Just Happened, her books on Nixon in Winter and Nixon Off the Record. She is the host of her own radio program. She is, of course, the fabulous Dr. Monica Crowley. Dr. Crowley, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
You have been very firm about the dangers that we're facing from what I think of as the global jihad movement. And I'd like to get your sort of after-action report on what we saw Friday in Paris and what is happening more broadly in Europe and, for that matter, elsewhere around the world.
Frank, immediately after the attacks, one of the things that I kept hearing over and over again was the word shocking. Everybody was talking about how shocked they were and how shocking these attacks were and how they absolutely couldn't believe it. And while I understand the trauma and the shock of experiencing an attack like this firsthand, because I was in New York City on September the 11th, 2001, I thought that the use of the word more broadly was inappropriate, because how, after all of these years, after decades, after Osama bin Laden first declared war on the United States and the West, how can we still be, quote, shocked by any of this? One of the things that the enemy always does, and I don't care what enemy we're talking about, but here specifically, the Islamic jihadi enemy always tells you who they are, what they believe, what they intend to do, and how they intend to behave. They never cloud it, they never cloak it, they never disguise it. They always tell you exactly who they are. And I'll recall the famous and now late American poet Maya Angelou once said, in a different context, but it applies here, she said, when someone tells you who they are, believe them the first time. And yet, time and again, Frank, and you have written so eloquently and powerfully about this, our good friend Andy McCarthy wrote a whole book on this called Willful Blindness. Time and again, the Western mind does not want to see the truth about this enemy. And so when attacks like this happen after decades, after millennia of the enemy telling us who they are and what they intend to do, we're still, quote unquote, shocked by this. And that is in large part the problem. If we continue this willful blindness, Frank, we're sunk.
Yeah, Monica, you know, I'm not sure that you can fight it effectively if you can't identify what it is and what its objectives are and how it is going to conduct itself. And I think that you're absolutely right. The thing that is shocking is that here, 14 some years on, we continue at the highest levels of the United States government and to varying degrees other allied governments to obscure from our people the true nature of the enemy. And I just want to ask in particular, Monica, because it's becoming very hot at the moment, as you know, is you're hearing, in addition, the United States government, the president and his immediate subordinates saying that notwithstanding the evidence that there was surely some involvement in this attack by people who had managed to get into Europe for the purpose of conducting these kinds of jihadist assaults, namely refugees or migrants that have been accommodated in Europe, that notwithstanding that evidence, the United States government is going to continue to bring refugees from Syria. And we're assured rather blithely, I think, that we'll be able to vet out are there any jihadists among them. What are your thoughts on that? And whether I'm right in thinking that a really shocking bit of business.
Yeah. What we are seeing now is the murder-suicide of Europe, and soon to come to our shores, the murder-suicide of the United States. This is the murder-suicide of the West. This is the global jihadi movement. What you are seeing happening across Central and Western Europe is not a refugee crisis, Frank. In fact, I'm going to write my column in the Washington Times about this and about what I witnessed, because several weeks ago, I was in Central Europe. I was in Vienna. I went to the Vienna train station as well as the main refugee camp about 20 minutes outside of Vienna to see this for myself. At least 10,000 people coming into that train station a day at the time. That has not subsided. What you're seeing here, this is not a refugee crisis. This is an invasion. This is what in Islam is referred to as hijrah. Hijrah is a core part of jihad. No weapons necessary to this point. Why? Because this is conquest through migration, which goes all the way back to the Prophet Muhammad, of course. This is what we are seeing. Are there some people fleeing the Syrian war and persecution? Sure, but they are the distinct minority. Only 10% of those coming into Europe are Syrian in origin. The rest are coming from North Africa and the rest of the Middle East. This is an invasion. This is an Islamic Trojan horse. And to have this administration talk about taking in, well, 10,000 over the last couple of days, but then their target goal is 200,000. And you know, Frank, when it comes to this administration, that's just the beginning. And by the way, there is no screening process. I was listening to Senator Lindsey Graham and John McCain. There is no screening process, Frank.
And when you hear Monica Crowley, that the FBI director is saying he's got, last I heard, was something like 900 cases in all 50 states in which the Islamic State is implicated. This is simply national security fraud, isn't it? That we're being told not to worry, we'll bring them in, we can sort them, we can assure that there aren't jihadists among them. It really raises a question in my mind whether what we're being told here isn't really tantamount to treason.
Yes, and now you're seeing other people, including presidential candidates like Donald Trump and others, raising objections to this process. This program already existed. You've written extensively about it, talked about it, Frank, the refugee resettlement program here in the United States, where you have had, you can put an exact number on it, over 100,000, hundreds of thousands have already come in from the Middle East and elsewhere, that from suspect countries, of course. And we don't keep tabs on them once they're here. That's what struck me in Europe as well, that they were coming in, there were no restraints or constraints on their location or behavior once here, or their whereabouts. Nobody knew where they were going. They all said, well, we'd like to go to Germany. Who knows? So they were able to float around Europe without being watched. And the problem is that that is already now happening here in the United States. It is absolutely outrageous. But the reason now that they have the protection is because, number one, they're under the guise of being refugees, political refugees, trying to flee war and persecution. So they're a protected class. But they're also a protected class because we have a First Amendment that protects religion. So under the guise of being Muslims, now they're protected in their mosques and elsewhere. What we have to wake up to, Frank, is that Islam is not strictly a religion. It is a totalitarian political system with religious elements to it. And until we wake up to that fact, we're not going to be able to fight this war in the way it needs to be fought.
Leslie, let me just ask you, Monica, because you're a close student of this going back to your days with Richard Nixon. Your assessment of whether, as the world looks at this president's conduct, it is essentially open season. Is that overstating the case as you see it?
Not at all. In fact, yesterday in Turkey, Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, sat by a coffee table and spoke for about 30 minutes. And they're calling it the unplanned coffee table summit, which was largely arranged as a photo op by Valerie Jarrett out of the White House. After that, what's reported is that Vladimir Putin rolled his eyes and laughed at the American president. how fundamentally immature and naive the American president was. That has been reported. That's not new. We know that Putin, the Iranians, the Chinese, the ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, the entire array of American enemies and enemies of Western civilization, the enemies of Israel, they all look at this president as a 98-pound weakling, and they have gone to town around the world. We know the lessons of history. We've seen this happen before. When the United States is weak in real terms or perceived as weak, the enemies of freedom advance, the good guys retreat, and the wheels come off the world.
Monica Crowley, thank you so much for your comments and your extraordinary work in so many media, as well as periodically here. Come back to us again very soon, if you will. Next up, Zvi Kahn will talk with us about the Iran deal and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Zvi Khan, a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy Initiative, who has had considerable experience in the public policy arena, the nexus between the Washington scene and national security, notably as an assistant director for policy at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, notably it's better known as AIPAC. He's also been a National Security Fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Always welcome here, Zvi. Good to have you again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been doing a lot of reporting and analysis at FPI's bulletin, particularly, Zvi, about what is going on with respect to the Iran deal. And I wanted to sort of drill down on this in two important respects. And maybe we could start with what exactly the Iranians are up to, what we've seen in the way of their conduct, both with respect to the deal itself and more broadly, since it was signed a few months back.
Well, sure. I mean, what we're seeing with respect to Iran, of course, it should not be surprising, of course, to anybody who's really been paying attention to what the Iranians have been saying and doing, not only over the last few weeks and months, but over the course of the entire nuclear deal. But what they're doing is twofold. Number one, they're pushing their luck with respect to the agreement. In other words, what they're trying to do is, in effect, almost renegotiate and extract more concessions out of the deal beyond the immense concessions that they've already received. In particular, what they've done most recently is they have attempted to, they have claimed that basically any attempt to enforce the deal by snapping back sanctions, which was already a weak enforcement mechanism to begin with, will in effect release them from their obligations under the deal. What they've also said is that the United States may not impose any terrorism or human rights sanctions under the deal, or at least that it would constitute a violation of the deal if they did so, even though the deal itself does not actually prohibit that. So what Iran has done is said to the United States is, if you actually attempt to enforce the deal, we will withdraw from it. What they've done, and secondly, is they've continued their regional mischief over the past few months. They are supporting the regime in Syria. They have continued to sponsor terrorism. They call for America and Israel's destruction. All these things are things, of course, which they promised to do and said explicitly that they would do during over the course of the negotiations. And they said explicitly that the deal would not prevent them from doing so because it would focus narrowly on the nuclear file. But what's notable about this is that the administration had argued is that the nuclear deal would hopefully lead to a situation in which Iran would moderate or would reduce some of these problematic activities. And what we're seeing now, of course, is predictably that it has not.
Let's just drill down on one other piece of this, and that is that the Iranians have seemed really to miss no opportunities to humiliate the United States for having done this deal. And one example of that is the fact that it was never signed. This really bespeaks the most distant thing you can imagine from a partner in good faith, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And you would think that, the administration had said that they would work extremely hard to ensure that this deal is enforced. They would call out Iran on its obligations. They would impose new sanctions on terrorism and human rights if they continued with that sort of thing. They would snap back sanctions if there were violations. So you would think that now that Iran is doing precisely what they warned Iran not to do, that the administration would act, that they would do what they said they would do. But in fact, we have seen really just almost a deafening silence. I haven't really seen any meaningful statement come out of the administration on Iran over the last few weeks. I mean, the closest we've come to is really when, Iran, arrests another Lebanese American as well, an Iranian American as well as a Lebanese citizen with a U.S. green card, which is also another way, really humiliating the United States. The United States simply says we are talking with Iran and we are working to do that, whatever that means. And of course, what that's notable is that given, that also begs the question is that given how much we have conceded to them over the course of the negotiations, what incentive really is there for Iran to listen to us now? If they have gotten everything they could for free, and if we're not really willing to call them out, now, why on earth should Iran not continue to behave this way? We've given them every incentive to do so, and that's what's so troubling about this.
Our guest is Zvi Khan from the Foreign Policy Initiative, and you can find his writings in all kinds of places, including National Review, The Weekly Standard, The New York Post, and other outfits, but not least the FPI Bulletin, a very, very valuable resource indeed. Zvi, on that point about what the administration has been doing, silence seems to me to be the most charitable way of describing it. You also use the term inert in one of your writings. What it seems is much worse is that they're contorting themselves to profess that none of this is a problem, that all of this is either consistent with what they presented to the Congress, to the American people by way of what this deal was going to be about, how it was going to work, or at the very least that it is acceptable on the part of the Iranians. And I think the point you've just made couldn't bear more reinforcement, and that is this can only encourage the Iranians to behave even worse. I just wonder what you think they might yet do, having rolled up people who are advocates of this agreement, Americans who've been proponents of it and encouraging business opportunities in this in their country pursuant to the deal, the ballistic missile tests, the additional threats, the additional, you know, terrorism. Is there more coming in the way of this kind of aggressive behavior by the Iranians, to say nothing of, you know, the nuclear file, as you say?
Unfortunately, I see no reason to assume that there wouldn't be. I mean, I would certainly hope I'm wrong, but if we send a message to Iran that we are not going to call them out on its misbehavior, particularly then when we explicitly said we were going to do so, and in fact, we're crossing over, the administration is crossing over yet another red line, so to speak. And he may not have phrased it that way, the way he did, let's say, with the Syria conflict a few years ago, but in fact, we're crossing more red lines, and if we're not going to do what we say, then why on earth should Iran not continue with their behavior? I mean, I can only speculate as to what they might do, but I think we have a pretty significant track record coming out of the Iranians. And I would also add to that, when you look at what's going on in the region more broadly, I mean, we're just a few days out of the Paris terrorist attacks, and Iran, as well as the rest of the world, will be watching very closely to see what President Obama is going to do. So far, the answer to that seems not a whole lot. And if, in fact, the administration does not take strong action against ISIS, I think Iran will draw further conclusions about its ability to continue with its own misbehavior against the United States.
And let's see, I think that's really the crux of the matter here, is that we will almost certainly see worse behavior, but probably not just from them. As I was talking about with Monica Crowley in the previous segment, this is only reinforcing, I'm afraid, the impression that an awful lot of bad guys have around the planet, that it's an opportunity for open season on America, its interests, its allies, during what's left of this administration's watch. It's a frightening prospect, to say the least, especially, as you say, in the wake of the vivid reminder Friday that you don't need to encourage these jihadists in particular to think that they can have their way with us. Zvi Khan, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I know you'll be following these issues closely, and we look forward to visiting with you again in the near future about them. This is, needless to say, a target-rich environment in the worst sense of the word, and we appreciate very much what you do at the Foreign Policy Initiative to keep us abreast of it all. Next up, we'll talk with Patrick Dunleavy about the prison problem and what's coming from that quarter, the jihad and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Barack Obama has serially lied to us. 3 years ago, he said Al-Qaeda was on the path to defeat. He said the jihadist murders in Benghazi were caused by a video. He said his disastrous deal would keep Iran from getting the bomb. On Friday, he said he had contained the Islamic State. Now, in the wake of that group's deadly attacks in Paris, conducted by apparently at least one Syrian refugee, he is saying he can screen those coming here to ensure none will be jihadists. Yet officials responsible for such vetting are warning that they can't guarantee that. This is national security fraud. Some call it treason. We must not accept any more of it. The place to start, as governors and other leaders across the country are urging, is by suspending further refugee resettlements. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
They are fathers and mothers, someone's best friend, and America's true heroes. Whether out on the front lines or here on the home front, our troops are sacrificing every day, making sure that we continue to have the freedoms that make this country great.
Hi, I'm Congressman Chris Stewart. As a former Air Force pilot, I understand that our troops and their families continue to give so much for our country. Let them know you appreciate their service. A simple thank you can go a long way.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. October 18th marked an important date for the nuclear deal with Iran. On this date, Adoption Day, the U.S. and the EU had to affirm that they will lift sanctions when the IAEA certifies that Iran has met several easy-to-meet requirements, probably later this year. The Iranian parliament had to agree to provisionally approve the NPT additional protocol, which gives IAEA inspectors greater access to Iranian nuclear sites. Meanwhile, however, Iranian leaders have made it clear they will not fully comply with the nuclear deal. Iran recently tested a long-range missile in violation of the deal. Tehran also placed some military sites off-limits to IAEA inspectors. In addition, Iran recently sent troops to Syria, probably paid for with sanctions relief from the nuclear deal. It is becoming more and more clear that critics who said last July that this deal is a sham had it exactly right. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Patrick Dunleavy, a man who has devoted much of his professional life to helping secure and assure that the society is protected against criminal elements, notably those involved in the jihad. He served, among other things, as the Deputy Inspector General of the Criminal Intelligence Unit of the New York State. He's also been involved in something called Operation Hades, an investigation that probed the radical Islamic recruitment movement for jihad inside and outside prison walls. He is the author of The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection. Patrick Dunleavy, good to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Fred.
There's a number of different elements to this that I'm anxious to cover with you. Maybe we could start with France. We've been talking a bit about that in the course of the program. The Charlie Hebdo affair was perpetrated by individuals who had spent time in the French prison system and apparently indoctrinated in the course of their jihadist program, including an individual by the name of Saeed Sharif, who had actually been in detention in Guantanamo Bay until he was foolishly released. We're glad to have you with us. Let's talk a little bit about perhaps that French story first.
Yeah, two of the individuals that were involved in the Charlie Hebdo attack had been at one point inmates, common criminals within the French prison system. There they were influenced by an Al-Qaeda member who was also in the same prison. Upon their release, they had made it to Yemen for training with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And there, they are alleged to have met up with Saeed Sharee, who was a noted Al-Qaeda bomb maker. Sharee spent 6 years at Gitmo, and he was released in 2007. Subsequently, after that, sometime later, he was killed in a drone strike by the United States, but not before he was able to continue his terrorist activity after being released from Gitmo and influencing what happened in France.
Well, I want to cover two very important pieces of this that you're expert in. Let's stay maybe with Gitmo for the moment. The president of the United States is, of course, determined to close Guantanamo Bay, as you know, and evidently there are some of the detainees that he seems to understand he simply cannot either turn loose on the world or get some other nation to incarcerate. Those individuals will be brought to our prison system for an uncertain duration because there may be lawyers and judges in this country who would try to spring them. But your professional judgment, Patrick, about the advisability of closing Guantanamo Bay and migrating such folks is very much needed.
Well, I think that there's several things that administrators are going to have to acknowledge and going to have to address. First of all, when you bring them to U.S. soil, you've now gave groups like ISIS and others an actual physical target that they can attempt to approach and free their friends and associates. The second is when you put someone into a federal prison, you give them rights and you give them access to the courts. There are terrorists that are already in the federal prison system who have gone to the courts in several different methods. One was an individual by the name of John Walker Lynn, the American Taliban, captured in 2001, 2002 in Afghanistan. He's been in the federal prison system. He recently won a lawsuit against the Bureau of Prison, easing his conditions of confinement based on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Another individual by the name of Kellen, who was involved in the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Tanzania, had petitioned the courts to have his conditions of confinement changed. And the judge in that, Judge Marcia Krieger in that thing, ruled that the conditions that were placed on him were unsupported by any substantial evidence or trial. So what happens, what I'm trying to say, is that inmates now in the prison system will have access to the courts to challenge things like their religious freedom, food, being able to be on the phone, being able to get visits. Those are all things that will become a quagmire.
To say nothing of the possibility of actually getting released on the grounds that some judge says that they're being unduly punished for transgressions that they don't believe warranted. But go ahead, third point.
Yeah, I was just going to say that Khalifan Muhammad, one of the things that he brought to light in his suit, he said, well, I've been in prison for 10 years and I've been rehabilitated, which again is a canard that a convict can use.
Trust me on this. I've been rehabilitated. But this raises the question, you know, Patrick Dunleavy, even if these guys remain incarcerated, the prospect that they would, in due course at least, have greater access to the prison population presumably means that you'd have these rock stars of the jihad able to greatly ramp up the kind of recruitment that you've documented takes place in our prison systems in your book, The Fertile Soil of Jihad Terrorism's Prison Connection. Why on earth would we want to do that? And isn't it already bad enough?
Yeah. You know, when a terrorist is not rendered harmless once he's put in prison. If he can, he will act. In the case of El-Sayed Nasser, while he was a prisoner in Attica, he still conspired to bomb the World Trade Center in 1993. And where a terrorist can act in prison, he will seek to influence. He will influence other inmates. He will be like a rock star.
And some of these guys are being let loose, as you know, under this rubric of criminal justice reform by either executive action or presumably in due course by a congressional mandate. In your professional judgment, again, Patrick Dunleavy, as a former deputy inspector general and as a man who had spent your life trying to work on these sorts of issues, what are the implications of having people who have either honed their jihadist tendencies or simply been imbued with the idea that this is a way to get back at a society that has wrongly punished them for whatever crimes they've committed, turning those loose on the American people? Should this be regarded as really a security threat?
Well, absolutely. But particularly if you're going to talk about the recidivism rates for common criminals, it continues to be an issue for sociologists, criminologists. How are we going to bring down the numbers for recidivism? Now you have an individual who comes out in prison who has been converted to a radical form of Islam and now begins to have a greater freedom to get on the internet to see some of the ISIS videos and everything like that. This is an individual who's already predisposed to violence, an individual who's already has somewhat of a grievance against the justice system or the government, and now we're hoping that he won't move on to another crime. But that crime could be, as in the case of Alton Nolan, who was released from Oklahoma Department of Corrections, I get in a beef with a coworker at a plant where I work, and I come back in and I behead her.
That's the kind of thing I'm thinking of, and I'm afraid that what's in store is probably much worse than that. If, as we're seeing in the aftermath of this set of attacks in Paris, a recognition that these people can interoperate with people in the population at large who share this Islamic supremacist agenda and may enable greatly the kind of threat that these former felons may represent to the rest of us. Patrick Dunleavy, there is so much more to talk about. I'm really very, very concerned that the kinds of sensible warnings that you've been issuing for some time about what's going on, what's being incubated in our prison system have not gotten the attention they do. We appreciate you spending a little bit of time with us for that purpose now, and I look forward to talking further with you about it.
Yeah, if I could just bring up one more thing, which is the release of five Gitmo detainees over the weekend. Right immediately following the Paris attack, there's a press release saying that we're going to transfer five Gitmo detainees to United Arab Emirates.
This is crazy.
The timing of that was could not have been worse.
Yeah, it's more of what we're calling national security fraud here.
You're returning men to the battlefield when the war is not over.
Indeed. Patrick Dunleavy, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much for your time today. Come back to us again very soon. Gordon Chang joins us next, our duty expert on Asia. Takes us for a tour there. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration's efforts to defend the controversial nuclear deal with Iran has become ugly, very ugly. Last week, during a speech at American University, the president portrayed opponents of the deal as partisan Republicans in common cause with Death to America chanting Iranian hardliners. The Tablet, a daily online Jewish magazine, ran an editorial on August 7th claiming that the president is using code anti-Semitic language to criticize Jewish Americans for opposing the Iran deal and to blame them if the deal is rejected by Congress. Some liberal pro-Obama groups have gone further and have questioned the loyalty to this country of Jewish members of Congress who oppose the deal, such as New York Senator Chuck Schumer. The president and his supporters are stooping to smearing opponents of the deal because the agreement is so awful and they cannot defend it on its merits. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Any Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Any Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. Gordon Chang, our duty expert on Asia and that of many eminent figures and organizations around the United States, including Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com and also Fox News, is in the house. We're delighted to have him with us, as always, to bring us up to date on subjects that he's been following closely and that we had best be paying close attention to. Gordon, of course, you've written about nuclear showdown North Korea takes on the world. There are several aspects to what's happening on the Korean Peninsula at the moment that are worth attention. Let's start with your piece about South Korea's divided loyalties and what that means for our interests as well as our alliance.
South Korean President Park Geun-hye has been trying to reunify the peninsula. And that's to her credit, of course. But she also believes that in order to do that, she needs Beijing's help. So she has moved her country very close to China and away from the United States. Now, fortunately, her defense minister recently issued a statement on the South China Sea, which was a little bit tepid, but nonetheless a step in the right direction. But it was only after President Obama chided her in public when she was in Washington recently, and also it was only after Ashton Carter, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, had to go to Seoul to twist the arms of the defense ministry there. So this is going to be an ongoing struggle that we're going to have with Seoul. We need to start paying attention, because if South Korea actually defects to China, that would have enormous consequences for the United States and for other countries in the region. And we really want to prevent them moving any closer to the Chinese.
Well, that certainly seems in our interests. She does not see it that way. Will it make any difference that the North Koreans, Gordon, are apparently pursuing peace negotiations or the idea of peace negotiations with the United States to exclude the South Koreans? Or will that only intensify Park's play with the Chinese?
I think that development, if it continues, would certainly move Park closer to China. I don't think the North Korean initiative will go anywhere, largely because it's an obvious ploy to get American troops off the peninsula. And I don't think the South Koreans really want that. But what is interesting is that the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, who is a South Korean, is scheduled to go to Pyongyang this week. He was also scheduled to go to North Korea earlier in the year, but the North Koreans canceled that meeting at the last moment. So we really don't know what will happen, and I suppose any scenario is possible. But clearly the North Koreans are trying to reach out to the rest of the world in a way to, of course, prejudice the interests of the United States and South Korea. And when the balls start moving on the table, you know, number of things could happen, many of them untoward. So this is a time for us to pay a bit more attention to the Korean Peninsula.
Gordon, you mentioned the South China Sea. I understand that the Chinese have begun deploying fairly advanced fighter aircraft on one of the islands that they've constructed in the region. Talk about that and again, its implications.
Photographs on Chinese websites at the end of last month showed that the Chinese were starting to put their advanced J-11 on Woody Island, which is in the Paracels. And that's a chain of islands which is north of the Spratlys that have been gaining all the attention. And the J-11 is essentially a Russian Su-27. It's a very capable aircraft, and certainly that is going to do a number of things. One of them, it puts into context President Xi Jinping's promise not to militarize the Spratlys. That's an oral promise that he made when he was in Washington in September for the state visit. And everyone thought that was an advance. Well, the point is, they're militarizing the Paracels rather than the Spratlys. But it does put into context Chinese intentions.
Gordon, one of the things that you've been very alert to and warning about is the sort of notion of the peaceful rise of China. Should this be seen as further evidence that there ain't no such thing?
Yeah, there ain't no such thing, unfortunately. And the problem is, it's you have a political system in Beijing right now that is in a state of flux. You have civilians fighting each other. We know that because of the continued purges in the guise of an anti-corruption campaign. And there are hints, as we've talked about the Chinese military becoming much more powerful in the Chinese political system as President Xi Jinping looks upon military officers, and especially those from the Nanjing military region, as the core of his political support. So we're seeing generals and admirals getting their way on a lot of things, and that is not a good sign. And so therefore, this is not a stable state. This is not a state that is bound to have peaceful relations, because I think Xi Jinping will raise the flag of nationalism even higher at a time of intense scrutiny on the Communist Party.
Yeah, intense scrutiny and increased political challenges, let's be clear. Speaking of political challenges, we've had, since we last talked, Gordon, further evidence that there's a very significant upset coming to China's hold or influence over one of its neighbors, Burma. What's the latest on that, and how does that likely factor into the broader regional efforts of Chinese hegemony?
The National League for Democracy, which is the political organization of Aung San Suu Kyi, won a stunning 90% of the vote in recent elections. They're not going to get 90% of the seats in the legislature because the junta is guaranteed essentially 25%, the military. But nonetheless, Aung San Suu Kyi right now is negotiating with the generals about what the shape of the political system will look like, because she is barred from being president by a constitutional provision that was designed specifically to keep her out of power. So there's a lot that's going on behind the scenes. China is now reaching out, of course, to the Burmese to try to buy the new government. This is something that it did, we saw in January, when a pro-China government of the Rajapaksa clan was thrown out in Sri Lanka. And clearly, we're seeing the same dynamics. But what's happened, though, is that China is losing, continuing to lose a series of elections, and they're going to lose one more, as we've talked about. That's the January 16 elections in Taiwan.
Gordon, one other thing that I just wanted to visit with you briefly about. I spoke last week with Bill Gertz, who, as you know, follows very closely Chinese military developments. He mentioned that the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission is expected to issue its report this week, I believe, and that it makes much of the rising capabilities of Chinese space power. Specifically, that they've now tested 8 anti-satellite devices, and that this has obviously very considerable implications for our security as well as our commercial interests. What are your thoughts on that, and shouldn't we be very much alive to the dangers there as well?
Yeah, the United States seems to have fallen behind in its capability of bringing down satellites. And part of this is, I think, a political decision on the part of the administration that they feel that if we have a capability, it will encourage other countries to develop theirs. Well, that's silly, because at this point, the Chinese, as Gertz points out, have a very highly developed program. They're continuing. They're making vast strides. And, you know, for us not to respond in a much more intensified way is really wrong. This is going to be a problem because we've become increasingly reliant on satellites, not only our military, but, of course, everything else. People are just going to have a very different life if we don't have any assets in space. And that's where we're going right now. So clearly, we're all awaiting the commission's report, and it's an important point for us to start thinking about how to bring this to the attention of the administration and giving it a much higher priority in budget discussions.
Well, at the very least, Gordon Chang, it's a requirement for us to restore our deterrent capability vis-a-vis the Chinese. And I think it reinforces a point we've made throughout the program, and that is the next 14 months are going to be hell on wheels in this international environment as countries like the Chinese consider that they may be able to have their way with the United States under what is left of President Obama's administration. Gordon, we have to leave it at that. Thanks so much for what you do at Forbes and Fox and World Affairs Journal and so many other places, but most especially here each week. We really appreciate it. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.